All right, welcome back. This is CS50. This is the start of week 7. So though this week we'll continue using the language C for the problems we explore, we actually begin to dive in next week into a bit of web programming. And for that, we'll introduce a language called HTML or XHTML, a little bit of something called CSS, both of which are not so much programming languages as they are markup or design languages with which you can structure a web page. We'll introduce a bit of PHP, a language called SQL with which you can query databases, and then a week after, another language called JavaScript. And this is all toward an end of applying the exact same kind of ideas that we've been exploring thus far this semester, but no longer at a boring black and white blinking prompt, but rather in a user interface with which you're much more familiar these days, namely the web. So that's what's on the horizon. Problem set 5, though, involves a little something like this. So this is one of the images that you might have seen already in PSET 5, which went out on Friday. Hidden inside of this image is actually a secret message, the answer to a particular riddle. And this is an example of what's generally known as steganography, taking an image, taking a picture that might just look like red noise or might look like a photograph that you took, and using a computer to manipulate some of the underlying bits that represent that image to hide some message. Now, we took a fairly simplistic approach, simply hiding in this red noise a cyan or a bluish message with which you can then for which you can then write code to recover the bluish text. But more generally, you can take an arbitrary photograph off the web, off of your camera, and run it through a program that maybe you write or that you download or buy, and actually have it hide entire paragraphs of text, entire books worth of text, depending on the resolution of the image. It's actually quite cool what you can do. And the implications, of course, are that you don't necessarily have to use cryptography, per se, to send a message. You can send someone an attachment containing an image that looks completely innocuous to anyone who might intercept it. And yet, if they run it through the special program and change, for instance, all of the pixels to red, or all of the pixels to blue, or something along the, or some of the pixels to red or blue, something along those lines, do they then see the message that's revealed? So if you like this sort of stuff, certainly Google around for something called steganography, and you'll see lots of really neat examples. But in this problem set, too, do we introduce the idea of images themselves in file format. So we introduced a week or two ago the idea of actually persisting your data to disk. Almost all the programs we wrote in the first several weeks, as soon as they quit, as soon as main ended, that was it. All state, all memory was lost that you might have built up while running this program. And then we introduced this ability to save files with fprintf. And in this problem set, we hand you some files, namely some BMP files for bitmap files that essentially look like this. If you've ever wondered how you actually go about representing an image, well, the simplest way, frankly, is just to assume that a 1 means white, a 0 means black, arbitrarily, and then with just those building blocks, can you implement the simplest of pictures? This is a little smiley face here. Turns out that all images, all image formats, are pretty much structured as rectangles, and so you need to have a row of pixels on the top, and then columns of pixels going top to bottom, and if you kind of take a step back, even though these things are not spaced in the same way, notice how each of the ones at top left maps to each of the white squares at top right. Similarly, our zeros black. And so this file up here on the left, if you stored those patterns of bits inside of a file, you could then say this represents a smiley face. Now, what does it mean to say it represents a smiley face? Well, you have to standardize how those bits are laid out in a file. This is probably an oversimplification, because these days, anything that has a three-letter file extension, .doc for Microsoft Word documents, .xls for Excel, .bmps for bitmap files, they are standardized in some way. Microsoft or Apple or someone on the internet said, you know what, if you have a file that ends in that extension, the bits inside of it are going to be laid out as follows. And so what we do in problem set 5 is introduce you to one such format, this BMP, bitmap file format, which pretty much does get implemented like this, but thankfully you can actually use 24-bit color, not 1-bit color, 0 or 1. You can actually have 24 bits per pixel, which gives you millions of total colors, as you'll see in the PSET. But what Microsoft said years ago was that for this BMP file format, the first several bits or the first several bytes in any such file have to be laid out in the following way. In other words, there has to be what we'll generally call metadata inside of the file that's not necessarily the data you care about. It's not the 0s zeros and ones that represent the picture, but it's some ancillary information like what's the width of this image and what's the height of it and what's the total size of this file. Little clues that might be helpful to programs like Photoshop and Windows and Mac OS so that when they open this file, they know what to expect and they know how to display it. So this is explained in some detail in the spec, although we don't care about a lot of these fields, thankfully, but you'll see fields called like BF size, which refers to the size of the file, BI width, BI height. And notice, even though this is laid out in a chart here, this is just Microsoft's way of defining the contents of a struct. So you'll actually see in a file called bmp.h that we implement this specification using a little bit of C code. And it looks a little something like this. Let me go ahead and scroll down. And notice that there is one of these structs. It's a struct called a bitmap file header. And it seems to have some of those same variable names. BF size is one of the ones I just mentioned there. So I won't go into great detail in lecture, because some of this information you don't need per se. And a lot of it is covered in the spec. But what is curious is that inside of these files are a whole bunch of data types that you might not have seen before. Word, D word. If we scroll down further, I think we see others. Long, in all capitals. So it turns out that in different languages, and sometimes different operating systems, there are, of course, different types. And Microsoft has standardized, at least back in the day, along the lines of these types. But thankfully, they map very nicely to a Linux computer or a Mac OS computer, so long as you know what to expect. So you'll see in the spec, in the comments here, that we use TypeDef, this thing for creating synonyms for data types, to say that, you know what Microsoft calls a word, we are going to call a uint16_t. So this is actually a type we haven't talked about, but thankfully, there do exist in C data types whose sizes do not vary based on the computer you're using, right? One of the little disclaimers in the quiz, zero even, was assume a 32-bit architecture like the cloud. Now, we have to say that because if you're on a newer, fancier machine like your own laptop, it might very well be 64 bits, which means some of the answers to quiz questions like how big is a long, how big is an int, might have actually differed depending on the machine. Now, this is incredibly annoying if you're the programmer, the computer scientist, and you need to decide for yourself how many bits to use to represent a number. You don't want your program to work or not work just based on what kind of computer your users happen to be using. So thankfully, even in C, there's this additional header file that we've not used before this called standardint.h. And that gives us access to these cryptic-looking data types, but whose names pretty much say what they are. So for instance, a word in the world of Microsoft we have defined as a uint16. And what does the U probably stand for? So unsigned. This just means I'm going to use 16 bits to represent a piece of data, but know that this piece of this value should be unsigned. In other words, don't waste one of the bits allowing me to have negative numbers in there. I'm only going to put positive number or non-negative numbers in this unsigned 16-bit int. Along in the world of Microsoft, if you read the documentation at these URLs, that's actually a signed 32-bit integer. So we looked in our standard int.h file and we pulled out this type, which is a 32-bit signed int, and then for a byte. And this is frankly the most useful in the problem set, because you'll probably use this same data type for the forensic aspect of it. More on that in just a moment. And notice that we have defined what Microsoft calls a byte, and what anyone in this room would now just call a chunk of 8 bits, as a uint8_t. So you could define a byte as pretty much just a char, right? A char, as far as we've discussed, is always just 8 bits. But that's not technically, even though we call a char, which kind of implies a character is going to go in here, that's not really a strict requirement. A char, in our context, is technically just an 8-bit value. And even though we tend to use a char to represent A's and B's and C's, technically you can put any 8-bit numbers in there you want, 0 on up to 255. So in this context, when you're actually working with bits in a file, bits inside of an image, a bitmap file, you really don't want to confuse 8-bit chunks, bytes, as numbers, as characters, because obviously an image is not going to have A's, B's, and C's in it. It's going to have just zeros and ones. So this is our way of specifying very precisely, assume that a byte is going to be an unsigned value. That is, there's no notion of negativity in this context. I only need 8 bits for a byte. And this typedef here mandates that in my code for this pset, I will always be treating a byte as 8 bits and with no notion of negativity. And this is a very useful thing so that your code doesn't break. And in quizzes, frankly, you don't have to have these parentheticals saying on this type of architecture. It will just work because now we have more portable types. But moving to something that's a little more fun, we did in fact take our stroll across campus, although the weather wasn't great the past week or so, so our stroll rather devolved into a stroll along Facebook and Google Images, where we actually found a whole bunch of fun pictures of computer scientists, one being Matt Chartier here, one of our teaching fellows. And what you'll find is that, as promised, I accidentally formatted my compact flash card on which I was taking all of these photographs. Now, it's not really possible to share a compact flash card, a little memory stick among 500 people. And so what we did was a sort of industry standard practice. We took and made a forensic image of this compact flash card. I plugged it into one of those memory card readers that most of you have, or I plugged it into a camera with a USB cable so that it could talk to my computer. And then I ran a special command on my computer that says, start grabbing all of the bits from this compact flash card until I say stop. And I said stop after about 4 million or so bits because I felt, okay, that's enough. I didn't take, you know, a gigabyte worth of photos. I just had a few megabytes worth. So I then packaged up a forensic image that's about 4 megabytes. And inside of there are all of the JPEGs from this problem set. So the program you're going to have to write for the latter part of the PSET is a program called Recover that opens up a file, namely this forensic image called card.raw, and it's going to have to iterate over all of the bits in this file from top to bottom. And every time it sees what looks like a JPEG, you should actually start copying those bits to a new file called something.jpg. And then the next time you see what looks like another JPEG, you close that previous file, you open a new one using a function called fwrite and fopen, as you'll see, and you start writing those same bits to the next file. And in the end, you should find yourself inside of your PSET 5 JPEG directory with 50 JPEGs, all of which were once on this digital camera's memory card. And then the real fun begins. On a per section basis, you are challenged over the next couple of weeks to find the people in these photos, Matt being one of them, and photograph yourself with them. And the section that does this first and most accurately will win, as we promise, an amazing prize. So. With that said, the Hacker Edition. So the Hacker Edition is actually mostly similar because this is frankly just too much fun of a PSET to deprive even the hacker types of doing some of these same problems. But in the Hacker Edition, will you find that one of the components of the PSET on both standard and hacker requires that you implement a program with which to resize an image. Now, resizing an image is actually relatively straightforward if it looks like this. If you think of a picture as a grid of pixels top to bottom, left to right, if I want to make this smiley face twice as big, well, I can simply convert each of these single pixels, these individual squares, to just 4. Right? Because if I move one pixel and make it too wide and too tall, that will essentially double the size of the image. So you can relatively easily do this with a couple of for loops. What's a little trickier, though, is if you actually have a bigger image, say a bitmap of Matt, and we say, don't blow Matt up, but shrink him down. Right? Then you have to decide which pixels do you throw away, which do you compress, and how do you actually take an arbitrarily large bitmap file and shrink it down. You're going to have to make some judgment calls in the Hacker Edition of this PSET. So, SFTP, quick demonstration of this. It is, of course, the case that when you SSH to cloud.cs50.net, you're sitting at your own laptop or desktop, and you're connecting to our servers, cloud.cs50.net, where you have your home directories and your storage space and all of this. Now, this is a bit of an issue if the purpose of this PSET is to write a program that creates JPEGs and bitmap files, but those bitmap files and JPEGs are then going to live on the cloud, which means you can't just double-click on them because, again, SSH has never been a point-and-click interface. And so you need a program with which to transfer those files down to your own computer. And thus, there exists this other protocol, SFTP, for Secure File Transfer Protocol. It's better than its predecessor, File Transfer Protocol, which was not secure. Passwords were sent in the clear. On a Mac, you can run, as the PSET says, a program called CyberDuck. It's a free program that you can download. You'll click a little icon like this, open connection, and there's only a couple details to be wary of here. And we have a how-to online so that you don't have to retain all of this right now. You'll see in this drop-down menu, this program can connect to servers in all sorts of ways with different protocols. The default tends to be this insecure one, so you want to make sure you're using the secure version if you're a Mac user. For server, you, of course, type cloud.cs50.net. You want to leave the port as 22. It's the same number that SSH uses. You type in your username, you type in your password, you click connect, and then you'll be connected to the cloud. And just as though you typed ls, you'll see the contents of your home directory. But now you have a GUI, a graphical user interface. So if you want, you can do things like drag a file and just over this window and let go, and the file will be transferred. Now, in the context of Windows, same exact thing, but with a different program. It happens to be called WinSCP. And if you follow the instructions here with screenshots, you'll see exactly the same process. And then it just boils down to the obvious. If you've got JPEGs on the server, click and drag them to your hard drive. If you want to upload something to the cloud, do the opposite process. So that is a little something called SFTP. Before I forget, the Harvard Science Review, a student group on campus, is looking for webmasters with which to make their website. This is actually a very common request this time of year as we look toward final projects in just a few weeks' time. If you are interested in joining them as a webmaster, go ahead to Google Harvard Science Review, campus publication, click contact, and let them know that you might be interested. And in fact, these kinds of things are certainly viable options for final projects in the course. But more on that on Monday when we dive into web programming. All right, so a couple whirlwind comments on quiz zero. So overall, it seemed to go quite well. We had a good time with it. But certainly do reach out to us if you have any questions or concerns, especially if you were on the lower end of things. Realize plenty of opportunities still remain with PSETs, another quiz, and the final project to bolster any scores with which you might be disappointed. But a couple of highlights of very common mistakes that we all saw while grading the quiz. So this was an excerpted line from the problem involving bottles, whereby there was a scoping issue. We declared a variable s, assigned it the string bottles, and then we printed it. A very common answer was that the problem in this program is that you actually have to dereference S by doing this. We'll refer to the online answer key to see exactly what the real answers were. But this is, in fact, not correct. If S is declared as a char star, it is, of course, by nature, a pointer. If you say char star gets hello, something like this. It is, of course, a pointer. Percent %s means put a string here. Well, what's a string? Well, we realized in the past week or two that a string is just a pointer to a chunk of memory. It's the first byte of an array of characters. So it's absolutely proper to just say something like s here. If instead you really wanted to use this star notation, what is that really pointing at? When you dereference s, what do you get back? The first character, right? Because the star operator is the dereference operator, and it says go there, there being an address. So really, if you really want to use that syntax, that's fine. But you have to realize that the appropriate format code is then going to be percent %c, because what's at that address specifically, at that byte, is of course just a character. So do let us know in section if you have questions about that question in particular. Another common gotcha was this one. So even though we talk about zero in many different ways, there's the zero that you type in at the keyboard, there's the zero, which is the decimal number, there's null, which is supposedly zero, there's backslash zero, which is supposedly zero. All of these things actually have different data types, or they're slightly different in different contexts. So realize that null's type is a pointer. When we say null in a program, you're technically saying this, in case you've seen this in any book. Null is type-deft in standard lib.h to be a void star 0. So what does this mean? This means, yes, it's 0, but it's a pointer. What type of pointer? I don't really know. So it turns out in C there exists this notion of a void star pointer, which just means it's a generic pointer. Could point at anything, I don't know, but it is in fact a pointer. It's not in fact 0. This is different now from saying quote backslash 0 quote, which is actually the null terminating character. Even though it's called null, most people write it as NUL, which is a stupid distinction to make, admittedly. But this is a character, so its data type is char. The relevance of this, of course, was in string length. When some of you were implementing string length, you probably did something like you probably wanted to check if s bracket 0 equals equals null. This was not correct, because if s is a string and s bracket I is a character, what you really wanted to check for was this. So just do beware of that distinction there. And then finally, this guy too. So backslash n is a new line, backslash r is a carriage return. This is not a sort of an important question at first glance, but it is important in the context of portability of files, especially as you exit the course, if you're doing research or projects where you have to import large files or data sets from other people. The fact of the matter is this stupid distinction across operating systems does tend to create problems. Linux systems use backslash n. Macs use, to denote the end of a line, /R, and then Windows uses, for good measure, both, /R, /N. So that's really why this is germane to anyone actually manipulating files in the end. And then this one, too. This one's pretty well explained in the problem, in the quiz solution itself. But do make sure you understand the distinction between including a header file versus linking against a piece of code. So looking ahead, you guys, for the first time this year, have to preterm plan, which means unofficially say to the world what courses you're probably going to take next year. So we actually thought we'd use this, and we'll discuss more on Wednesday, as an opportunity to consider what kind of mindset you should have going into final projects. So we recently surveyed all 1,600 or so people that used Harvard courses this past fall. This, again, was the CS50 app with which you can shop for courses a little more easily. We got back responses from these folks. We've taken into account all of their suggestions, kind of considered what were the most important feature requests. And on Wednesday, we'll release a newer version of this that improves upon this previous version. The point here is not so much to dwell on this particular application, but when it comes time to design final projects, especially if you have your eye on doing something that affects campus, affects other people, builds you a startup of sorts, asking these kinds of questions, how do you design software well, how do you design with user interface in mind, is certainly important. And we'll also reveal some of the gripes some of you had anonymously with various programs and machines you've seen in the world, excluding the MBTA system. So any questions administratively on really any of all that? That was a lot of boring stuff, I felt. All right. No more boring stuff. All right. So Mather House. So this was where we left off right before quiz zero. And it was teasing you with the notion of some additional data structures. Thus far, our toolkit's been pretty sparse. We introduced variables way early on in week zero with Scratch, so you could actually store some data. We introduced lists in the context of Scratch, so you could have like an inventory for the fruit playing RPG, that kind of context. And then in C, we had arrays, which were similar to lists. But we had some frustrations with arrays in C already, whereby you have to know their size in advance. You can very easily seg fault if you go too far. So there's some downsides there. We began to address some of those downsides with that data structure by introducing linked lists 2 weeks ago. And what was one of the selling points of a linked list versus an array? So you can insert at any point, rather than an array whereby if you want to put something in the middle of all these people, we would have to say, you know, please move all the way down, and then every element has to be moved, which is expensive. That's a linear time operation. With a linked list, you find your location, and then you just say, you know, excuse me, just move one person over, and then update your pointers, which only took two or three operations in total. You, of course, still have to find that location, but at least you have this dynamism. Moreover, with a linked list, you don't necessarily have a bound on how many elements you can fit. You're only limited by the amount of RAM in your computer, the amount of RAM that malloc is willing to return to you. But what's a downside, someone else, of using a linked list versus an array? There's never a 100% improvement. What's the downside? So you lose random access, whereas in an array, you knew that everything was equidistant. And so you could use this square bracket notation and just jump magically, immediately, to any element in the array. With a linked list, you can't just jump to the middle element, because you don't know where that middle element is. In fact, with a linked list, you only know where the first element is. Thankfully, he or she knows where the next element is. He or she knows where the next element. So everything is chained together nicely. But you do, in fact, lose that random access. Now, who cares? What's the downside of losing this random access? Linear search. All right, so the searching process devolves into something linear again, right? You can't leverage binary search. You can't leverage divide and conquer. You can't leverage some of these really useful, if simple, ideas that we've been taking advantage of for some time. So again, there's a trade-off here. So the data structure we introduced next was this notion of a stack. And this was actually just to formalize a data structure we've been using for some time. So the stack of trays conveys this idea that when you put a tray on top, the one that you are going to take off first, unless you want to make a huge scene, is going to be which one, obviously? So the top, right? So a stack is a data structure where it is last in, first out. Or a computer scientist would typically write LIFO, last in, first out. Now, this might seem a weird structure. For instance, it would be kind of unfair if an amusement park implemented a stack for the line, right? That would mean the last person to get online for some roller coaster is going to be the first one to get on. Might be great to be that person, but it's not necessarily quite fair. Now, we have certainly used a stack in the context of computing, right? The whole layout of memory leverages this idea of a stack, which is useful because it does make sense that when a function gets called and another one, you don't want to jump back down to this guy. You want to slowly unravel the stack and pop frames off one at a time. But sometimes a queue makes more sense. So a queue is another data structure in computer science terms. We've now got linked lists. We've got arrays, but arrays are very limited data structure. We have the notion of a stack, which we could certainly implement. And we have the notion of a queue, which we could certainly implement as well. And it turns out now that we start talking about more interesting, more sophisticated data structures, many of them can be implemented in code with previous data structures. For instance, if you wanted to implement the notion of a queue, a line, the idea being for a queue that you implement a FIFO structure, first in, first out. So the first person online at 5 a.m. in the morning is the first one to get out of line and be able to buy the iPhone in this case. So how, with what data structure could you implement a queue? In other words, if you want to implement a new struct in C, and you want to call this thing a queue, and it's going to have the properties of FIFO, first in, first out, well, how do you represent the individual people? Or let's just number them. How do you store integers in a queue? What data structure could you actually use in C? So we could just use an array, right? In theory, Apple, for fire code reasons or management reasons, they might just say, you know what, we're only going to let 1,000 people line up outside the store, or 100 people. So in a sense, it might be reasonable to bound the number of slots in your data structure. So a queue could really just underneath the hood be in an array. And that array can be a fixed size. But what do you then have to be careful of? Well, I can implement a queue, just sketching this out partly in C, partly in pseudocode here. I might call my struct a queue. And my queue might actually have, let's say, int members, the people in this queue. And it's going to be bounded at 100. So now I have a struct called a queue. And I could then have a function like pop. So let me do int pop. And it's going to take in a queue, let's say, star pointer. And the purpose of this function in C is going to be return to me the next person that should be removed from the queue. So in other words, a data structure, more generally, is the a data structure generally has not only data associated with it inside, it also typically has some standard operations associated with it. And even though we didn't highlight this with linked list, a linked list's operations are the ones we played with. Delete is an operation on a linked list data structure. Insert, search, sort might be another one. So anything we've been calling a function or an algorithm, you can think now is applying very specifically to a data structure. So a common one for a queue is pop. Or you can call it different things. But the purpose here is that I call this function. I pass in a queue. I want it to return to me the number of the person who should be removed from that queue next. So now let's just brainstorm for a moment. If I pass in a queue and I need to be told who the next person in line is that should be allowed into the store, how would I possibly implement that? Do I need additional data inside of this data structure in order to implement that idea? What is the rule? All right, so the rule is, again, FIFO. So for a data structure like a queue, suppose we've filled it up with 100 people or 100 integers. The rule is when I call pop, I want the first person in line. Now, what does that mean in this context? What should pop return in the simplest case? The next element in the array. Or actually, if we want to return the first person, you know, why don't I just keep it simple? Return member, whoops, return members bracket. Okay, zero, right? So it's just an array. So if you want to return the first person in line, just return members bracket zero. But what's the problem now? If, again, the point here is to implement a queue, if the Apple employee executes the same function again, who's going to be allowed into the store next? Like same guy, same person, same person, same person. So this is clearly flawed. So the next time around, what do I return? Well, pop needs to know something more here. Members, oh, actually, this is the wrong syntax. Remember to get at something? It's queue arrow members. Take the struct called queue, go there, and return the members' zeroth element. What do I really want to do? Well, more generally, I don't want to return always the first person in line. I probably want to return the person at the head of the line. But head might be a variable. Where should I store this variable? How can I possibly keep track of where someone is? So maybe local, but if I put a local variable inside pop, as soon as pop returns, I'm going to have forgotten who I just removed from the list. So inside the struct, right? So don't forget, a couple weeks ago when we introduced a student struct, whenever we had data we wanted to keep together, like an ID number, a name, and a house, we just lumped it all together inside of the same struct. So, you know, I could just do this, int head for my queue, and the head variable is what ultimately keeps track of who's next in line. So now I might say, go ahead and get the person at the head of the line by accessing the same queue structure, its head field, and return it. But I'm not quite there yet. What's the problem now? Who's going to get pulled off the head of the line the next time I call pop? So I do need to iterate, but who specifically is going to get popped off the front of the line the next time this is called? This is the same person, right? It's not sufficient to generalize who gets popped off if I'm not actually going to maintain this data structure. So really, I want to do something like this. Int next gets the person who's currently at the head of the line. Agreed? All right. And then ultimately, I want to return this next person. But what do I need to do first? Right, I need to plus plus this. So really, I want to say the person at the head of the line should now be the person at the head of the line plus one. So now I've taken in this data structure. I've grabbed the person who's supposedly at the front of the line. I then say, OK, the next time, let me plan for this. The next time, go ahead and call the next person, which is equivalent to plus plusing this. So I could actually simplify this. This is, in fact, identical to just saying this. And then I return not the current value of head, because then I'd be skipping the first person in line. I then return the person that I called next. Now, there's one bug here. What's going to happen eventually with this implementation of pop? At the end of the line, I'm going to seg fault, or I'm going to at least start touching memory that's not actually there. So this is, though, the Apple employee is kind of like is going to like start talking to no one at the end of the line, trying to pull more and more people that just aren't there. So we need a fix here, and what operator probably saves us? What's that? Not or, but what do we do generally when we want to wrap around? Right, so we could do something like this. Head gets Q, head plus 1. And then we can make sure that we always stay within the boundaries of this array with something like this. But again, I'm kind of skipping a step here. Now if I implement this as follows, this assumes that there's going to be a continual flow of people. I presumably now need, if I'm going to allow this to wrap back around to the other side, what do I also need to keep track of, apparently? What's that? So the end of the line, right? I need to keep track of how many of the 100 integers that I've reserved space for are actually legitimate candidates to be removed from this data structure. So I'm probably going to need another integer in here, something like int size or something along those lines. But here's where things start to get interesting. When you're designing a data structure to solve a problem, you typically wrap up the data you care about inside of a structure. You implement one or more functions with which you then start to manipulate that data. So that if you have a goal in mind, like let me implement in code this notion of a queue so that a computer program, one of these employees on a little iPhone, can be told who should be popped off the list first, well, you could implement this using these kinds of data members. And we'll look at this in more detail with problem set 6 next week, but this is just a taste of the thought process that goes into actually designing interesting data structures, not these most simplistic of ones, arrays and linked lists that we've looked at thus far. But all of this generally reduces to leveraging this new feature, this power called pointers and memory addresses in C. Unfortunately, you can do a lot of damage using pointers in C, both in terms of security, as we've discussed with buffer overflows, and just in terms of correctness. Probably almost everyone in this room has had a seg fault at some point of some sort because you've touched memory that doesn't belong to you. And sometimes these problems can be hard to spot. You might have looked at your code before submitting it for some PSET, felt pretty good that, got it, there are no bugs in this code, and then your TF finds something nonetheless. Well, this is not necessarily the easiest thing to debug on your own, and so thankfully some tools exist. So Valgrind is a program we'll start using for problem set, you can start using for problem set 5. It's particularly germane, as you'll see, to problem set 6, that essentially analyzes your code for you, and if it can, tells you where you've made memory-related mistakes so that you can proactively fix them so that your code isn't broken, doesn't get downgraded certainly, and ultimately is better written. So let's take a look at an example. This is among your printouts for today. It's a simple program called memory.c. But I wrote this intentionally to have a couple of flaws. It doesn't do all that much. At the bottom of this file, notice I have a function called main. Its sole purpose in life is to call the function f. And then it returns 0, just by default. And then what does the function f do? Well, it returns nothing. It takes in no arguments, as indicated by void here. But it does do a couple of things, albeit uselessly. It first declares a pointer to an int called x. It then mallocs how many bytes? So 40, right? If we assume that an int is 4 bytes, it's going to allocate 40 bytes using malloc, storing the address in x. And then it appears to, at the 10th location in this chunk of memory, so at the location of the 11th integer, 0 index, it's going to arbitrarily put the value 0. But this is problematic because how many ints did I actually allocate? So only 10. If I'm indexing into this array at bracket 10, I've gone one step too far, right? This is a buffer overrun. It's not really an exploit because you're not going to compromise a machine really with just the number 0, but you are in fact overstepping the bounds. So you might be able to catch this just by looking through the code, but not necessarily. So let's see what this program can actually do for us. So I'm going to go ahead and run this command. It's Valgrind. It's that's the command. Dash V is a switch that says beaver boast. Tell me as much as you can. And then dash dash leak hyphen check equals full says do all of the memory leak tests that the program is designed to support. How do I know this? I read the man page, or frankly, I ran just Valgrind and it yelled at me and it told me to run this other command instead. So that's how you can remember. So let me go ahead and paste this in. First, let me make the program memory. Seems to compile. If I run it, seems to work just fine. If I run GDB on it and then run it, seemingly a program exits normally. So it looks like it's OK. But let's see if Valgrind knows better. So let me run this command on the program called memory in my current directory. Enter. Wow. So a whole bunch of text flew by. That's what happens when you tell a program to be verbose. A lot of this is not all that interesting. It's a bit more arcane than we'd care about. But you can skim through it, even if this is the very first time. And you can kind of look for the proverbial red flag. So let me scroll down to, oh, this is interesting. Invalid write of size 4. And I say it's interesting because it's not cryptically referring to all of these files that I've never heard of. It's referring actually to something I wrote, memory.c, line 23. Then let me scroll down a little further. Oh, and this is bad sounding. 40 bytes in one blocks are definitely lost in loss record 1 of 1. All right, so it couldn't be more verbose. But the point is, it's again my code, right? So it's finding fault with my code. So let me look a little closer. Let's do the first one first. So invalid write of size 4 apparently induced at this address, but that's not useful to me, the human, at this line number, 23 in memory.c. So let me go ahead and open memory.c. Line 23, aha, line 23 is this thing here where I say x bracket 10 equals 0. And the error message being indicated there is, again, this invalid write of size 4. So what does it mean by saying size 4? So it's an int, right? I'm storing an int, namely the int 0. It happens to be 4 bytes. And so that's why it's saying invalid write. You know, it's not completely holding my hand and telling me how to fix this problem. But now I see, oh, line 23, there's definitely a problem there. Bam, I've now detected my buffer overrun. Now, Valgrind can't necessarily do this in all contexts, especially if your program is more dynamic, takes user input with getInt or getString or the command line. But at least in this case, we can catch that error. What else did it yell at me for? Let me look at the other error, which was this one. Let me rerun the command. It was toward the bottom. Invalid write of size 4. We saw this. Ooh, definitely lost 40 bytes in one blocks. That was not good. And here it is. Memory.c colon 22. So let me go into memory.c, line 22. It's the one above it. Oh, so I'm losing 40 bytes. Well, why is that? Well, apparently I'm not doing what? I'm not calling free. So let's actually see if I can fix this. Again, the program's still pretty pointless, but let me at least knock off one of these. Anytime you call malloc, henceforth, you should absolutely be calling free, but you want to be calling free on the same pointer that malloc returned, which is x in this case. Let me save that. Let me remake memory. Let me go ahead and now run Valgrind again and see if it yells a little less. OK, good. Now I only have one errors, and oh, so they have such a fancy, sophisticated program. And again, they didn't even parenthesize the S. This is really just an if condition they could have had. So even experienced programmers cut corners sometimes. All right, not that you should. All right, so this problem still remains. So in short, there's a whole lot of cryptic output. But thankfully, with Valgrind, you don't have to care about most of it. Looking for any mentions of your code and your line numbers can absolutely start helping you chase down any kind of memory-related bugs. But we see this recurring theme here. So every time we look at memory, every time we look at pointers, we see things like this. And I had to use this slide because I thought it was the cutest thing ever. So, all right, five of us think this is cute. So this is, of course, hexadecimal. So why do we keep using hexadecimal? So we already have binary, where you've got 8 bits, or actually, you only have 2 digits, 0 and 1. We've got decimal, which we all grew up with, which is 0 through 9. Hexadecimal has 0 through 9 and A through F. So this is 16 total characters. And why hexadecimal? So someone just asked the other day after class, you know, why use 16 characters? Why not 12? Why not 14? Well, you absolutely could. There is base 12. There is base 14. There's base 20. There's any base system you want to come up with. What's particularly nice about hexadecimal, though, is that if you're representing 0 through 9 and A through F, that's 16 total digits. To represent 16 total values, how many bits do you need? You only need 4, so with 4 bits, 1, 2, 3, 4, I can represent, of course, the number 0 pretty effectively, and I can represent the number 15, so this is a total of 16 possible values. So what's nice about hexadecimal is that because hex, implying 16, is a power of 2, what it means is that with one hexadecimal digit, you can represent 4 bits, and thus with 2 hexadecimal digits, you can represent 8 bits or 1 byte. So anytime you see OX just saying, here comes hexadecimal, 01 or 02 or 03, it's just a nice human convention because that 0 and 1 are actually represented using 8 bits in total. For instance, 0x01, if we write this out, let's go ahead and do 0x01. Well, if you actually implement this in binary, well, this first 0 actually represents 4 bits, so that's actually the bits 1, 2, 3, 4. This 1 is actually 4 bits, so that's the number this. No, it's just the number 1, so 1, 2, 3, 4. This means the value we say OX02 is just 0, 0, 0, 0, then 0, 0, 0, 2. No, right? So what's 2? It should really be 1, 0. So it's still just binary from, you know, several weeks ago. This would be 1, 2, 3, 4 for the 0, then 1, 2, 3, 4 for the 3, and then finally, if we keep going up in this way, let's go up to FF. This means 4 1s. Four ones, now we have the number 255. So hex is just a nice way of saying, expressing a number in 4-bit chunks at a time. So why is this actually useful? It's because with this notation, it makes it really easy to start manipulating data at the bit level. Thus far, we've only focused on things like integers and maybe chars, but we've never really cared about the underlying bit representation. But now for this pset and now for this part of the course, where we're actually talking about files and representing data persistently, being able to twiddle or tweak or flip, just change a 0 to a 1 or a 1 to a 0, can actually give us a great deal of new power, which we'll take a look at in just a 5-minute break. Okay, so we are back. I haven't exactly vetted this, but given that the subject of steganography did come up here, I thought I'd at least do a quick Google search, and let's assume for the moment that Wikipedia has gotten this right. Here is an image of what appears to be a nice sky and a tree, but it turns out that a subset of the bits that compose this picture have been tweaked in such a way, and by tweak I mean zeros have become one, ones have become zero, or something along those lines. It turns out that if you undo those changes, what you actually get back out of this picture is that picture. So you, okay, that cuteness was not the point. So what's powerful here is that, again, you can read the article. This is just the Wikipedia steganography article. What's powerful here is that you can take really an arbitrary image, and if you are using enough bits to represent each of the pixels, each of the dots, you can hide a lot of additional information, whether it's text or whether it's a cat or anything else altogether. So realize this is a very powerful technique, and we're just scratching the surface of it with problem set 5. So We promise to do some of these lower level bit manipulations, and we actually have this ability. So in the past, you've used the ampersand and you've used the vertical bar for the purposes of conditions and Boolean expressions. Ampersand, ampersand is a Boolean and it says make sure this and this is true. And then we had the vertical bars, which was make sure this or this was true. Now it turns out if you actually use just one ampersand or one vertical bar, they have very different meanings. What it allows you to do is what's called a bitwise and or a bitwise or there's some other operators altogether. What bitwise means is that this operator will let you take an 8-bit char or 32-bit int or 64-bit long, and it will allow you to change from 1 to 0 or 0 to 1 any of the 8 or the 32 bits or the 64 bits in that particular number. So it's a step toward implementing something like the tree to cat transformation if you can actually manipulate bits at that level. And in the context of PSET 5, you won't necessarily do it at the bit level, you'll do it at the byte level in terms of the red, green, and blue values in the pictures we give you. So let's actually see an example of this in action. Let's try a simple one first. So in binary.c, which is among your printouts today, we have this code here. It's not all that long. It's got a do while loop whose purpose in life is just to ask the user again and again for a non-negative integer so that we have a number to play with. And then down here, there's a bit of fanciness. So first, let's actually take a look at what the program does, and then we'll delve into how it's doing that. Let me go ahead and make binary. I'm going to go ahead now and run binary. And I need a non-negative integer, please. Let's start with the number 3. Enter. And it looks like I've provided an integer. It's the number 3. But to represent that as binary, you have what appear to be 30 zeros and then a 1 and a 1. And this is consistent, presumably, with what we know to be the binary representation of 3. Let's do one other. So let me go ahead and do something like 255. I should get a whole bunch more ones. And sure enough, I do. And let's try something even bigger. Let me go ahead and type in, like, big number. So that happens to map to this binary number. So assuming this is correct, how is it actually doing this? Well, let's take a look. So most of this code, uninteresting. It's just a do while whose purpose in life, again, is to get an int from the user. So the magic is in here. And here's how relatively easy, if it's a little cryptic at first, it is to start manipulating individual bits. What's my goal here? Well, I know just from how computers are implemented that an integer is inside RAM 32 bits. So what I really want to do is get access to each of those individual bits from the right-hand side all the way over to the left. In other words, if I know conceptually that the number 3 looks like this, I want to be able to print out those bits. And so actually, I think I misspoke. I want to start at the leftmost bit in this integer, and I want to print out what it is, a 0 or a 1. I want to then move to the next bit, the next bit, the next bit. So in other words, I want to take the actual integer and iterate over all 32 of its bits. So how can I do this? Well, let's take a look. So first, I'm going to declare an int I. I'm going to declare I to be the size of an int, so that's 4, times 8, so that's 32, minus 1. So I is initially 31. Why didn't I just say I equals 31? I wanted this code to be portable. If you ran it on a newer Mac or PC, I wanted to make sure the code didn't break on you, so I generalized the size of an integer in case it varies. So I is initially 32, and this is kind of old school now. It looks like this loop is going to go from I is 31 on down to 0, equal to 0. So this loop is going to iterate 32 times. Now, why 31 and 0? Well, whenever you write out a number in binary, the convention is if you write 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, this bit here, the rightmost, is what's generally known as the lowest order digit, the rightmost digit, the lowest order digit, lowest order in the sense that this guy is the least contributing number in this whole number. It's got the least weight in terms of the grade school columns, the one column, twos columns, four columns. This is the smallest column, so it's the least ordered bit. By contrast, the guy all the way over here on the left, that's the highest order bit. So he's the most powerful bit because he contributes 128. That's the 128th column in the context of binary. So we generally number then by convention the right-hand side, this would be bit number 0, and this guy over here would be bit number 7. And by contrast, if we have 32 bits, 0 would be over there. The 31 bit would be over there. So you number it in sort of the opposite way you might think. All right, so what does this mean for our code? Well, I'm going to start at the 31st bit and move my way down to the 0th bit. So conceptually, this is right. I'm going to iterate over all 32 bits from left to right. What do I need to do? Well, when I have this integer, n, that the user provided, that just gives me this high-level number, the number 3, the number 1 million, whatever they typed in. I need to dive in and actually look at individual bits. So there's this notion in programming called a mask. So I've declared a variable of type int called mask. I've set it equal to this fancy thing. So this is literally the number 1 that we're familiar with. What is that really equal? Well, if it's a binary number, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32. So that is the number very tediously represented in binary. So that's what I get if I do int x gets 1. But I'm not quite doing that, or int mask gets 1. But I'm not quite doing that. I have another line of code, another part of an expression here. This is the left shift operator. So it means literally take the bits in this number and shift them over to the left. Now, obviously, that's going to leave you with some blank spaces on the right. So by default, those should get filled in with zeros. So the effect is really, when this left shift, it's going to move all the ones and zeros that way, and it's going to fill the placeholders with zeros again. So what does this mean? Well, I is initially 31. So this means that this 1 effectively is going to get shifted over a whole bunch of places. And I can't quite depict this perfectly on both sides, but I shift it over once, now it's there. One more time, now it's there. 31 times total, it ends up there. And as promised, this gets filled in. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Here, I'm going to learn how to copy paste. Damn it. I learned how to cut. All right, paste, paste. 0. OK, so that is the result of not just initializing mask to 1, but saying initialize it to 1, but then shift those bits over 31 places, or more generally I, where I equals 31. Now, what was the point of this exercise? Well, now I have conceptually this thing called a mask. And a mask is generally, and actually the same idea exists in Photoshop. If you guys have ever played with the notion of a mask there, in that context, it's usually black and white or red and white, something like that. But the point is that there's two states. In this mask here, there's two states, 0 and 1. The 1 on the left-hand side is essentially conceptually a hint that I care about that bit. All the other zeros means I don't care about those bits. So now what I can do is essentially line up this mask with a given number, and I can just look at the number I care about by, as we'll see, anding them together. So let's look at the code. I initialize mask to that long sequence of bits, and then I do this. If n and mask. So if n and mask print a 1. So what does this mean? Well, n, recall, is this. This is my mask now. So let me lay this out nicely, make this bigger. So that's my mask. N, let's say, is the number 3. So n is, here we go. That's the number 3. So now what I'm saying is and these two things together. So I'll just lay it out kind of like a mathematical expression. So I'm going to and them together. And what that gives me, it's very sophisticated ASCII art, what? So the Boolean AND operator, just like the bitwise AND operator, the single ampersand, just like the Boolean AND operator, says for an answer to be true, both of the inputs must be true. If you want an output of 1, the inputs must both be 1. So what this means is let's do 1 and 0, and the answer is 0. What's 0 and 0? It's also 0. Or again, in the world of bools, is false and false? Well, the answer is false, so we write down a 0. This is the same question again and again and again. What happens when I get down here? 0 and 1? 0. 0 and 1? 0. So the answer to n and mask is what number? It's 32 zeros, which we know to be the value false, right? False is anything that's non-positive and non-negative. So anything that's 0 is false. So and n and mask returns the Boolean expression false. So does this condition print 1 or 0? So it prints 0. But this is useful because, again, here's n. I want, but n really, when I typed it in, is the number 3. But underneath the hood, n is this, and I want to print out its leftmost bit. Its leftmost bit is a 0, and indeed, I'm about to print out a 0 because of this condition here. Now, we don't have to repeat this story 30 more times because it's pretty much the same. If I now let my loop continue, the next iteration, I equals what? So it's not 31, it's instead 30, right? Because I'm doing I minus minus. So what does this mean? Again, I initialize mask to 1, then I left shift it 30 places, which means, again, if I've got 1, let me cheat here. If this is the value 1, and then I shift it 30 places, that gives me what value? It gives me this value. So now my mask on the second iteration is almost the same, but the bit I care about now is not the leftmost one, it's the second leftmost one. And now as this pattern repeats, I is going to get decremented and decremented. So your mask looks the same, except that one, the single one, is kind of inching its way down toward the end of the string. Now once you get to the end of the string, what's ultimately going to get printed out? Well, at the very last iteration, the last couple of iterations, my mask is going to look like this. This is my second to last mask, and my last mask is going to look like this, right? Because the one is going to keep moving along to the right-hand side. So let's go ahead and do this last second to last one. 1 and 1 is going to give me 1. 0 and 1 is going to give me, oh, sorry, we're not at that point in the story. All right, so now the last iteration, my mask is this guy here. 1 and 1 is 1, and so it gets printed out is 1, 1. All right, sorry. I feel like I didn't say this very well. At the end of the day, what is going on? We're using the mask to tell the computer we care about one bit and only one bit, and it's this particular bit. We're then using the Boolean AND to essentially extract only that bit and print it out. So that the end result, after we've iterated 32 times, is that we've printed out 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, until finally our mask lines up with this bit, and our mask lines up with this bit, and we actually print the number that we care about. Okay, so let's actually use this power for something that's otherwise been done in a different way, and we'll see what the implications are of this new capability. Let me point out this. I'm going to keep using my little cheat sheet here, and I'm going to remind us that the value A is the number 65. Well, what is that in binary? The number 65 in binary is really 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's the number 65 in binary. Agree, disagree? Right, because that's the 64's column, then the 1's column, so that's the number 65. And what was the number, the letter little a? 97. Oh, too fast. 97. All right, so how do we represent 97? We need a 1 there, and then we need another 32. I think that's it. Agreed? 64 plus 32 plus 1. So that's the number 97. Here's a curiosity that we've never really leveraged before. Big A and little a are always 32 digits apart, and we know this just by simple arithmetic. 97 minus 65 is always 32. But there's an interesting side effect, probably deliberate, of that fact. What is the only difference between the binary representation of 65 and 97? There's the single one in, coincidence, the 32's column, right? This is the 1's column. This is the 2's, 4's, 8's, 16, 32's. They only differ in the 30's 2's column. If we do a little sanity check here, what about big B and little b? Well, this would be the number 66, which means that is this. And then the number little b is 98, and that just means this. So you know what? That pattern is going to persist. So these big and little letters are always only differing by one bit position. So you know what? This gives us a new capability to capitalize a number if we want, or lowercase it. Let's go ahead and look at this, tolower.c. All right, let's scroll down. Again, this program's almost completely boring, except for this one line of code. So you've called the function tolower. You might have looked at this on the quiz zero itself, but notice what we do here. In the top here, I just ask the user for an uppercase character, please. I use get char, and I ensure that the user gives me an uppercase A through uppercase Z. And then I execute one line of code that's going to do something really quite neat. Let me go ahead and make tolower. Run tolower, enter, uppercase character, please. Let me give the letter A, and I get back lowercase a. Let's do b, little b, uppercase z, little z. Well, how is that working? Well, take a look at what's going on here now that we understand how to manipulate individual bits. Printf, percent c, so that's uninteresting. Print a character. What character? Well, it looks like print the character c bitwise ORed, vertical bars OR, with 0x20. All right, well, let's just bite these off one at a time. So 0x20 is actually what? It's 1, 2, 3, 4 bits, followed by another 4 bits, as per our discussion of hexadecimal. Let's do the easiest ones first. The last 4 are all 4, are all zeros, because that's this bit here. And then what about these 4? What should I replace these 4 placeholders with? 0010. So this is an interesting thing. It looks like 0x20, because I know what hexadecimal notation is just a succinct way of representing a binary number that has a 1 in which position? The 32s only. So now I'm saying this expression here in code, take C, which is going to be the number 65 or 66 or so forth, and OR it with 0x20. So what does this mean? Well, let's take A. This is A. Let's OR it with this expression here. And now just do our notion of ORing. So this position here, 0 or 0 is 0. 1 or 0 is, oh, careful, is 1, right? Because the OR, just like in the world of Boolean, something or something, only one of them has to be true. So true or false gives me true. False or true gives me true. False, 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 true. So my answer to C, ORed with 0x20, is this. And you know what that equals? This here. So now using this bit flipping, or bit twiddling, as people are fond of saying, can we actually flip a bit individually? What about the opposite? If I actually wanted to force something to lowercase and implement on the fly to lower, this is very easy. I just tell the user to give me something different. And now how would I go about turning off that bit? I don't want to OR it. So OR typically has the effect at the bitwise level of turning bits on, changing zeros to ones, as we just saw. So we do want to use AND. But if we just AND it together, is that going to give us the right answer? In fact, if we AND these together, notice what's going to happen. I'm going to get all zeros, which is definitely not a uppercase A. So what do I really want to do? I don't want to AND it with this. I want to AND it with, what about the opposite? Let me temporarily just come up with a second line. Let me flip these bits. 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. What if I do this? What will that give me? This will give me what? 0, 1. Doesn't seem to be helping me, is it? Or it is. That is, in fact, capital A, right? If you look here and then look here, that is, in fact, capital A. So let's see this in code. Let's go ahead to upper.c. And in fact, it's as simple as this. Now, how did I come up with this hexadecimal code? Well, df, this one's actually pretty easy. Same thing. I just said df. So oxdf equals, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. The last 4 of these are pretty easy. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then what's d? So d is actually 13, because a is 10. B is 11, 12, 13. So what does this represent? 1, 1, 0, 1, DF. All right, now that we have this ability to manipulate bits at the individual level, can we start to implement much more interesting data structures? So it all comes full circle in that we talked briefly today conceptually about stacks and queues. And these allow us to perform different operations on data and also represent them in more sophisticated ways. But suppose that the problems we want to start solving are not these trivial play examples of like people in line or students in a queue and so forth, but suppose that we actually want to solve some real world problems. Well, one of them might be implementing a spell checker, right? Problem set 6, as we've teased you with before, amounts to being handed a huge text file from us which has 140,000 English words in it, and you are then challenged to actually represent all of those words in memory. Now, a very simplistic implementation might very well be to just take those 140,000 words, allocate a really big array, and store one word after the other, and maybe you'd alphabetize to keep things slightly optimal, and then you can perform binary search if asked the question, is this word spelled correctly? And I say binary search because given a word, you can quickly look it up in your huge dictionary and check, is it actually present? If so, it's obviously spelled correctly. If not, it's presumably not spelled correctly. So that would give you an answer. But binary search is log n, which isn't actually all that impressive relative to a better running time, namely big O of 1. Big O of 1 represents what notion of running time? right, constant time. And in fact, thus far, we've been pretty content to just have log n running time, or even n running time, as opposed to n squared or the like. But what if the holy grail really is to get constant running time? Where if I ask a question, I want the answer now. I don't want to wait n. I don't want to wait big O n squared. I don't even want to wait log n time. I want that answer now. Case in point, something like Google probably is not doing linear search and probably not even binary search over the billions of pages that it actually has in its database. Hopefully, there's a much faster way so that I get my seemingly instantaneous reply. And the ideal, of course, is one step. Give me an answer in just one step. So one of the questions we'll be able to ask now that we have some of these new skills is if I have a container for data, what's something we'll generally call a hash table, into which I can put numbers, I can put students, I can put words from a dictionary, how can I put those words or those humans into these buckets of a hash table in such a way that when I ask for that person or that word again, you can get this answer instantly? And to motivate this, ultimately with problem set 6, not only will you be challenged to implement the fastest spell checker possible that's correct, you will also be challenged to implement the fastest spell checker vis-a-vis your classmates, if you choose to opt in, whereby we'll rank on the course's homepage what your running time currently is, what your amount of RAM currently is, so that we'll have a bit of a race next week, if you choose to partake, to implement the fastest spell checker in CS50. So with that little teaser, we will see you on Wednesday. That's it.